Somebody quipped once, if God had wanted us to have quiet, he would have equipped us with earlids. You know, it's you stop to think of it. Why do we have eyelids, you know? And well, in fact, the eye has several schemes for protecting it from overstimulus. If you go out, as the level of light changes, why, the eye has an automatic diaphragm stop, as to use photographic terminology. When you go outside, your pupil closes up. When you come inside, it opens up. So there's a mechanism right there that automatically compensates for changes in ambient level of light. But then if you get a really bright stimulus, why, you just involuntarily blink. And I suppose one could muse that reason.
This is what a noisy one is?
This is what a noisy one is. That is 65 decibels, in case you want to know what it is. You know.
The time was all wrong, too.
Yeah, what are you
going to
do to him, Tom, for putting up a wrong sign?
Well, 20 lashes of the wet noodle, how's that sound? Well, I've just been talking about the eye and how nature protected that, you know, but the ear, we just don't have anything built in to protect it. We've got to use a little common sense. If we'd been, you stop to think of it, we've been exposed to a very wide range of light stimuli. For many, many years. You know, the sun's been around there for a long time. And so it's quite natural that the human carcass would evolve protective mechanisms for the eye. But actually, this tremendous range of acoustic stimuli that we experience is a rather recent innovation. We just haven't had foundries and rock and roll bands and jet aircraft and so on for these many million years, or maybe we would have some kind of a mechanism. Now, the closest thing the ear has to a mechanism like that is a rather drastic protection device, just fatigue. If your ear is subjected to enough loud sounds for a long enough time, and we're going to talk in detail about what is enough and what is too much and so on, it just begins to desensitize itself. And that, of course, is what most concern about environmental noise is designed to avoid. We would rather not desensitize our ears. We'd rather keep our ears sensitive enough so we can hear crickets chirping, and we can hear the whole symphony orchestra, not just what's below 4,000 hertz and things of that nature. But in order to do this, we have to use a little common sense about the places we work, about the places we live, and about the environment in general. Well, I'm going to have to talk decibels. There's just no other way, really, to describe the ear. We were born with ears that have a logarithmic response, a decibel response, there's just no other way to do it. In fact, all of our senses really are logarithmic. By logarithmic, I mean that twice as much stimulus does not produce twice as much response. A linear response means that if you double the stimulus, you double the response. But in a logarithmic, the response goes up much, much more slowly with stimulus. Maybe I can draw this upside down. If you have a linear response, that means that when the stimulus goes up, the response goes up. Let's say this is response and this is stimulus. But in a logarithmic case, the response goes up much more slowly, something like this.
Would you draw it more on the screen so we can see it?
Oh, is it behind the fireplace hood? Okay. all right. This is not very significant in itself, but I want to get this point across, that why we insist on talking about decibels. In particular, the decibel is a decibel is defined, those of you who remember something about logs from high school, is defined as 10 times the logarithm of the pressure ratio. But in plain, honest-to-goodness, everyday language, why, that means if the sound intensity, that is, the energy content in the sound, goes up by a factor of 10, you've gone up 10 decibels. But if it goes up by a factor of 100, then you've gone up 10 twice, so you've gone up 20 decibels. 30 decibels means a factor of 1,000. 40 decibels means a factor of 10,000. Okay, so much for the mathematics. I won't. That will be all the mathematics we'll talk about today. Well, now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on talking about the ear. If some of you are interested in the physiology of how we hear, I'll attempt to answer your questions at the in the discussion. But suffice it to say, the ear is nonlinear in its response, and it also is not uniform across the frequency, whole frequency spectrum. We hear sounds around 1,000 hertz. That's, for musicians, that's a couple octaves above middle C. We hear these with the maximum degree of acuity. And above that, there's a slow roll-off, but below, say, 100 hertz or so, or a couple hundred hertz, there's a rather fast roll-off. In fact, I've forgotten exactly what curves I did sketch here. I was sketching a few things here before the lecture. Yes, let me erase this. There we go. Response of the ear to pure tones, I've tried to sketch here. This is the frequency. I guess if I'd known I was going to have so many musicians, I should have drawn a keyboard down here instead of writing numbers. But this is roughly the range of human hearing from 20 up to 12 or 13 or 15,000 hertz, depending upon age. And the response is much rolls off. Quite a good deal at low frequencies. In other words, to hear a sound at 50 hertz and judge it to be about the same loudness as another sound at 1,000 hertz, you'd have to be something like 20 or 30 decibels louder. So it doesn't pay then in trying to measure noise levels to just measure the absolute amount of sound energy in the environment. You want to weight it in somewhat the manner of the ear. Now, you can readily see the weighting network that you'd have to use, the weighting curve you'd have to use, is quite different for loud sounds than it is for soft sounds. And there are several weighting networks like this used in noise studies, but the one that's used at least 90% of the time, and perhaps more, is what's called an A-weighted sound level. Here I've sketched in the lower curve. I've sketched the three most common networks that you'll find if you go down to the any place from Radio Shack to a scientific supply house and buy a noise or sound level meter. Why, it will have probably have three scales, an A and a B and a C scale. But almost all environmental noise studies are expressed in terms of the A scale. And so you've probably seen, if you read the papers about noise legislation, OSHA sets the environmental noise level, factory noise level, at 90 dBA. That means 90 decibels above the reference level on the A scale. So the A scale takes into account the fact that high frequency noises are much more annoying and much more damaging than low frequency noises. Well, what are some of the effects of the of noise on the ear? Well, I think I wrote those down. Maybe I forgot to bring that along. Yes. All right. First of all, of course, is loss of hearing. And we're going to talk about that probably in more detail than any others. But there's both a temporary threshold shift and a permanent. Nature has been very kind. She gives us fair warning. And if you go to work in a noisy factory and work 8 hours and come home, you'll find that your hearing is considerably less sensitive. But after an hour or so, or even less, it will recover. But now if you do this day after day after day after day, why then you induce a permanent shift in threshold. Now, obviously the permanent threshold shift is a good deal more worrisome than a temporary shift. And there are studies that show that the degree of temporary shift, say after so many minutes of recovery time, approximately predicts the amount of permanent threshold shift in hearing that you'd experience if you stayed in that same environment 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for a 20-year period, for example. So nature does give us a lot of warning, but until rather recently, we've tended to ignore this. Well, probably second to actual hearing loss is interference with our so-called normal or desirable activities. And of course, one of them is conversation. Conversation is stressed a great deal here. And of course, we have a rather ideal environment for conversation because it's so nice and quiet everywhere. Even with when you turn a fan on, it isn't very noisy. But there are an awful lot of places where conversation is just too difficult to bother with, you know. You sort of figure some environments, you just, oh well, to heck with it. It's just too hard to listen and talk. And again, there are some rather definitive studies of speech interference, how much of a noise level produces a 5% loss of intelligence, and a 10% loss, and a 20% loss. Another certainly is, well, there are other normal activities, just the chance to sit down and listen to the news, or listen to some music, or just relax. Then there's the whole problem of interference with sleep. Now that's probably less data on this than most other aspects of noise, because it isn't just a matter of absolute level. If you're in an exceedingly quiet place, why, you can be awakened by just a sudden change in the ambient noise level. It's a rather complicated thing of background against suddenness of noise. Then there are other physiological effects on which data is continually being gathered. Again, it's something that a lot of more research needs to be done. Certainly, hypertension is something that's very much related to noise. There's been enough data kept to show that blood pressure tends to be higher in people who are exposed to a great deal of environmental noise. There are a lot of psychological effects. There's work efficiency. There's just irritability. And I personally think that there's enough data to show rather conclusively that the violent behavior is very, very much depends upon the level of environmental noise. And this is certainly one of the reasons. There are certainly many reasons why violent behavior tends to be a more of a problem in a dense urban area than in a quiet rural area, but certainly this noise has to be one of these if people are continually subjected to this noise stimulus. Their behavior responds accordingly. Okay, well, where do we stand on noise legislation? Well, the biggest single step, well, there have been a number. I could go through the history of noise legislation. I guess one of the EPA documents cited a manuscript from ancient Greece, dating 1,000 years B.C., that a community had passed a law outlawing roosters and metalworking inside the city. That probably has to be the first piece of noise legislation. But in modern society, noise control legislation has been more or less neglected. The Occupational Safety and Health Act, which many of you are familiar with, included noise criteria in factories. to protect workers from loss of hearing. Of course, that's been the subject of a lot of controversy. There's been tons of paper written on the subject, estimates of how much the OSHA laws are costing industry, and I suppose on the other side of the coin, who can tell, you know, who can put a dollar value on human hearing? So it costs so many $100 million to meet OSHA laws. That's approximately so many cents per ear, and who puts a cost on that? Well, the biggest single step, as I said, was the Noise Control Act. How old does that have to be for the people across the fireplace? Of 1972, which was kind of, it was enabling legislation, really. And it was designed, quote, to promote an environment for all Americans free from noise that jeopardizes their public health and welfare. That's governmentese, of course, but there's a lot of, you know, that's rather well written. Now, the problem is to decide what is necessary to protect the public health and welfare. And if any of you have had anything to do with public health regulations and laws, you know that this opens up a whole can of worms. And what one person feels is as a proper level of risk for the public health and welfare is not what another person feels is a proper risk. And of course, this is the, you know, this cloud veils the whole field of environmental protection, not just noise, but protection of the air and protection of streams. How much can we stand? How far should we go by legislation to protect the health and welfare of the public? And how much shall we just leave it up to the individuals and say, well, if you don't like going deaf, move to the country, you know, or if you don't like breathing bad air, move to the country. Well, that's really a topic for a whole other discussion, the ethic of risk, public risk. But anyway, the Noise Control Act of 1972 did define, I think rather intelligently, a division of responsibility between the federal government and between the state and local governments. The federal government, through the Environmental Protection Agency, was chartered, given the responsibility of establishing criteria for noise. That is, the criteria that would be necessary, and supporting it with data, gathering together all the data that would show what levels it really would take to protect the public health and welfare. But then, over and above that, the federal government was given some regulatory powers. Mainly as they affect interstate commerce. And of course, as Paul Hain pointed out the other day, nowadays interstate commerce includes almost everything, except maybe the corner grocery. But the federal government, the EPA, was to attack, really, the noise emitters themselves. For example, one of the first things they came out with was a set of standards for construction equipment, heavy construction equipment for jackhammers and air compressors and things. And what they've done in most of the most cases is set up, first of all, standards for new equipment, and say that after such and such a year, no portable air compressor shall be introduced into interstate commerce which emits a sound of more than such and such, and then write the standards and give the manufacturers of this equipment a reasonable time to redesign their equipment so that it meets these standards. Then, of course, the next step is to put standards, write standards for existing equipment, which requires retrofitting, which requires modification equipment. Now, just recently, the EPA published a set of standards for trucks, and of course, as you can imagine, there's a lot of shouting and fist pounding going on in Washington, arguing on truck standards. But I think, to me, they seem very reasonable, and I think the trucking industry will eventually accept them with perhaps minor modification. But one by one, EPA is going at these major noise emitters. The federal government, however, is not supposed to and has no intention of setting environmental noise standards. That is a privilege or a responsibility that's left up to state and local governments. It's up to each community to decide what level of environmental noise it can tolerate. And this, of course, is one of the things I hope that will come out of this discussion. I hope that some of you will go home and ask your neighbor who's on the city council or on the county board or in the state legislature, what are we doing locally here? Most states now have some type of legislation regulating environmental levels, but some of them are very, very lenient. Some are more stringent. Local ordinances are just coming into being. I was at attended a EPA workshop in Atlanta last spring, in which we talked about a model local ordinance, and that will be coming out very soon. I think it's just a suggestive thing. It leaves a lot of blanks, but it sort of helps local communities that are interested in noise control. They don't have to hire their whole legal staff to write these ordinances, so that they cover all the anticipated loopholes and stand the test of constitutionality and all that. But the blanks are still there. They're left for the local communities to decide on. For instance, the community of Englewood, Colorado, which is a suburb of Denver, is almost always used as a model. They've set up a very stringent environmental noise control program. Apparently, the people wanted it, and it's working. But some other communities where there's a heavy industrial base, they may decide it isn't worth it. But at least I hope that you people will give this some thought, what you want in your own community. Well, the federal government, as I said, was supposed to gather together all the scads of data within the engineering and acoustical and public health literature pertaining to noise as it affects health and public welfare. And they've recently published a fairly definitive study now I've put a very brief summary of what's in it. There's, it gets technical, sure, but this is a rather brief summary of what they've concluded, at least at this point, is necessary to protect the health and welfare of the public with, quote, a reasonable margin of safety, end quote. And they define that as being the level that would not produce any appreciable permanent hearing damage or permanent or appreciable level of annoyance that at least 90% of the people would not say we're annoyed, it's far too noisy here, under various conditions. For instance, to protect hearing loss, they recommend that the equivalent sound level, I'll explain just a minute what that means, should not be greater than, it should be less than or equal to, that's simple, 60 decibels. Now, by equivalent level, that's a kind of a 24-hour average. There are many different ways of expressing sound. I said, if you hold up a sound level meter and measure the sound pressure level in this room at this time, you'll get a number. And you'll, if you use an A weighting network, you'll say that's so many decibels on the A scale. But it might be noisy right now, and half hour later when I shut up, it'll be quieter. And the range of a day or an hour or even a minute, the sound level varies a great deal. So there are many different statistical ways to express level. The two that appear the most frequently in noise criteria are the LEQ, which stands for the equivalent level, and that is kind of an energy average over a 24-hour period. And then another one that appears quite frequently is LDN, which stands for the day-night level. And all that is the equivalent level over 24 hours with 10 decibels added to the noise level between the hours of 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. to take account of the fact that noise at night is a little bit more annoying to most people than noise in the daytime. So these are equivalent levels. And they feel, the EPA at least feels, and this is certainly going to be subject to debate, I'm sure. I know we have at least one person in the audience who does private consulting work I'd be interested in hearing his comments on the EPA standards. I'm sure there are going to be a lot of industries and so on that aren't going to like these particularly well. But this of course means that a person can work so many hours at an 80 or 85 dBA level as long as he gives his ears a little bit of rest during 24 hours. The level which the EPA study says would avoid interference with outdoor activity, normal outdoor activity, is an equivalent level of 55 dBA. And for indoor activity, 45 dBA. I should probably have put this on before. We were talking about permanent threshold shift. I really wish I had brought along, I didn't anticipate doing this, I had brought along some slides and things. Well, I really wish I'd brought along a couple of sound level meters and we could sort of measure the, because you really don't get a feel for what is a 45 decibel environment or a 50 decibel environment or 60 until you've measured various places. But now the in the upper graph, we've plotted the level of sound pressure that will produce no more than a 5 decibel permanent shift in hearing threshold, and to be precise, that's at 4,000 hertz, but that's a typical place. Well, in fact, that's the worst place. 4,000 hertz is usually where permanent hearing loss begins to show first, and then if the hearing loss is extensive, it'll extend to other frequencies. But in order to avoid 5 decibel permanent threshold shift in a majority of the population, you'd have to work keep the sound level down to 70 to 80 decibels. In other words, if the in an equivalent environment of 85 decibels, why almost everyone would experience some hearing loss. Environment, I'm at an angle here, in an environment of about 77, 78 decibels, about 50% of the population would experience some hearing loss. And in order to get it down to 5 or 10%, in other words, to protect the health and welfare of the whole population, why the level should be down in the 70 dB range. Well, these are some typical environments of sound. In the first one now, a factory worker who sleeps at home at 30 decibels perhaps, or 35 dBA, provided he keeps the windows closed and he's not in right next to a major freeway or a railroad or anything like that. And then he gets up in the morning and normal activity brings the indoor level up to maybe 50 to 55 decibels, and then he commutes to work at 75 dBA average level in a car or commuter train, and then he gets into a rather noisy working environment where he works right up at the OSHA level. OSHA has set the level now presently in for factories or for any kind of employment at 90 dBA. Let's say he works at the maximum OSHA level. He takes a lunch break. The cafeteria isn't quite as noisy. He goes back to work again. he comes home and relaxes a while, flips on the TV set, and finally goes to sleep. All right, the result of all this, if you send it into a computer or your friendly slide rule, it comes out with an L equivalent of 87 decibels, which is not, is in terms of our criteria now on hearing loss, is not a very desirable level at all. His hearing is definitely going to deteriorate after he's done this for a number of years. Typical office worker, again, wakes up, commutes. Of course, he commutes in just as noisy an environment as the factory worker, but his office is reasonably quiet, so he works in an environment of 50 to 55 decibels, depending upon the kind of an office, and takes his lunch break and comes home and so on, and his L equivalent is 72 dB. Well, what's in those numbers? Well, from our hearing loss curves, you see that there's considerably less chance of his hearing being impaired than the factory workers. Now, I talked about the Noise Control Act of 1972 and its various ramifications. I haven't talked much about the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA law. This is designed to protect the worker while he's at work. It doesn't say anything about his getting sleep at night or his not being subjected to a noisy environment during the rest of his 24-hour day, but it protects him at work. And presently, the OSHA level is set at 90 dBA. It says that, it's a more complicated thing than that. It says that if the worker, if he's in a 100 decibel environment for 4 hours, why then that uses up his whole daily dosage of noise. If he's in a 100 decibel environment for, say, 2 hours, that uses up half his daily dose. So the rest of the day he should work no more than 85 decibels. And it's a cumulative thing. In other words, you can stand so many hours at so many dBA, so many hours at so many dBA. But if you were at the same sound level all day, it would be at 90 decibels on the A scale. Now, there is a strong move afoot to reduce this. EPA recommended this should be reduced to 85 dBA. There are a lot of people that feel this should be reduced to 80 dBA. But presently, at least the legislation calls for 90 dBA. Well, as usually happens, I ramble on and on. I'll be glad to comment any more about any phase of this, but I want to stop at least at this point and get some of your reactions to noise. Yeah?
Does it sound cumulative, like if you have a radio on and a truck goes by and a fire engine goes by? Are all those added?
Right, but in a rather subtle way. For instance, if you're adding, let's take those, which are all broadband sources, then it's all right to just add total energy, which says that, for instance, if you have two 80 dB sources, both of which are rather broadband, why the sum of those two will be 83 dB, because 3 decibels represents a doubling of the energy content. Are you mathematically inclined? The log of 2 is 0.3, so you take 10 times that, you've got 3 dB. So 3 dB is a doubling of the sound energy. As soon as the sources cease to become broadband, combining of them is somewhat more complex. And I don't want to cloud the issue with a lot of technical data here, but the way it's usually done then is to divide the noise up into narrow bands, either octave band or third octave band for some things, and add the levels in each octave band and then reestablish the dBA.
Now, 2 years ago, the federal government did something about controlling the level of commercials that hit the TV screen in terms of, I guess, decibels, what I would call volume. But now I've noticed, and then I noticed a slacking back. So when the program was over, the commercial came on and it seemed to be about the same. Eventually, though, it kind of crept up. And I'm wondering if actually they have crept up, as your chart identified, not in terms of decibels, but in terms of pitch, so that if it's measured technically, it is not an increase in volume, but it's an increase in the sharpness of it, and that's what makes the difference.
Well, I don't know the I don't know what the regulation is, but I'm sure that if it's written, it would not be in dB as such. It would be in percentage modulation. In other words, there are other ways of measuring the what you can put on a carrier wave on a in communication. And I've never seen any about that. You're saying some years ago the commercial had to be at a lower level than the program material?
The jockeys in the radio and TV station were, when the commercial came on, were turning it up higher,
yeah.
Yeah, so that you would have to quickly rush over and turn it down. Then when the program came back on, whatever you're watching this, and do you have to go back and turn it up because the program is at a lower level.
I see.
And I'm wondering if they got away from that because of the... if you identify the law, probably wasn't written strictly that way.
Yeah, well, of course, these laws don't... The FCC covers communications. These laws only control noise emission. And, of course, you can't control noise emission from the TV set as long as there's a volume control on it. That's left up to the individual. But I've often wondered what the regulations are on commercials. It seems to me they used to say so many minutes per hour could be commercial. But there are stations now that are running close to one-third commercial time, especially on if they show a first-run movie, they run just about a third of the time as commercial. A two-hour movie takes 3 hours on TV.
You talked about the effects mainly on people. Are there other kinds of effects, like building to structures and effects to wildlife and, other kinds of effects besides the people?
Well, the answer has to undoubtedly be yes, but I think they have not been researched terrifically well. There was, of course, some data on at the time of the big SST controversy about what sonic booms do to buildings. I don't think that there's very much evidence of structural damage from even from sonic booms. Occasionally there are windows broken, things like that, but I honestly am not I'm skeptical of these reports that people say that cracks in their plaster started to appear and so on. The level at which it would take to produce something like that with an impulsive sound, a sonic boom, are so great. But wildlife, I don't know of any studies, no. I'm sure that biologists have done studies of laboratory-type sound, on animals. Sure, we know how rats and mice and so on respond to sound, but I don't know that there's been any extensive work. I know that up at the University of Wisconsin, there was quite a large study on the effect of snowmobiles on wildlife up in the North Woods. I know a couple of graduate students that participated on that. And they got some rather surprising results, like deer were attracted to snowmobiles and things like that, but they were a little hard to explain, except that I guess they thought that where there was noise, there were liable to be people, and where there were people, there was liable to be food, and there were just all sorts of complex things. They wired a whole bunch of deer with a teletransmitter and kept track of where they were every hour of the day, and they found that they were actually attracted to, not repelled by some of the mice. At least EPA is not worrying about animals. Their charter is to protect public health and welfare, and that's defined as the human population.
I seem to be really hypersensitive to noise in general. I mean, it just irritates me. I get cross. Well, now, does that mean that my hearing might be injured sooner than someone who seems to be able to happily sustain more noise? Or is it just
a psychological
thing?
You're saying is, do you have hypersensitive hearing or do you have hypersensitive nervous system?
I don't think if it's the nervous system, then will it damage the nerves?
Probably not. The criterion, you know, these psychological effects usually occur at a appreciably lower level than the physiological damage. And I don't know. Well, I couldn't answer this, whether that is more liable to, I can only guess really, that it's more liable to be that you have hypersensitive nerves than that you have hypersensitive hearing. Of course, the one way to find out is to take have your hearing tested with an audiometer and see what whether your threshold is somewhat above the average.
Well, I was thinking, what would I get from always being cross about sound?
Imagine you being cross.
Oh, wow.
I'm talking to Dale about that.
That can be calm in most situations, but noise just really gets into that. I was wondering, if maybe you would be desensitized faster. So you sort of protect yourself in that way. I don't know.
Can you sort of... I turn off sound. My wife went to school in Chicago at the Roosevelt College, and she did it at the dorm last summer, which was over the L. And the L happened to be right where there was a turn. And so the wheels were squeaking, and she said that after about the third night, she sort of started to turn it off.
Turn it off, yeah.
And was able to sleep well and refreshed in the morning.
It seems as if some people have ability to do this. Well, I think the younger generation has demonstrates that. I cannot work efficiently in the kind of environment that my kids can work in efficiently. I work faster and more efficiently, make few errors if I have a quiet place to work. But other people claim to be able to work in front of a TV set, in front of a hi-fi, where there's multiple conversations going on and everything else. I've never been able to tune them out. That must be something you can train yourself to do. But I probably didn't do it early enough. I grew up out in a small town in western Minnesota. I didn't have to.
I was going to say that's like the guy in the lighthouse and that thing was going bong,
Yeah.
One night it quit and he jumped out of bed and said, what was that?
Well, this amazing ability of mothers to hear a baby that just turns over a little too hard. Well, they're sound asleep. They jump up because the baby made a slight sound. You know, they just.
I was wondering about this. I answered the phone and hear real well, and then one member of the family will want me to put in a little sentence or a few words, and then all of a sudden I can't hear. I don't know what was said on the person continued talking to me, and then I don't know what the member of the family said, so there I am.
You lost both conversations.
I mean, sometimes my wife is, she answers the phone, and I can say a sentence or part of a sentence, but she knows what I mean, and she can tell me. But those two things just cut me right off.
Mm-hmm. Are there any studies?
I guess you can train yourself, can't you, so that you can listen to two conversations at once, or even three conversations at once. But it's a matter of training, I think. Yeah.
And the boss to talk the second.
Yeah, the same time. But
yeah. We seem to understand very clearly how pulsations in the air are translated into stimulation of nerve endings.
Right.
But what you do with the pattern of stimulation of nerve endings and how this is treated as background noise or information, how it is treated or simply ignored, that we don't understand at all.
Right.
I know my dad used to love to do his work as a professor, sitting in the front room with his card table in front of his favorite chair and the family doing their things around the house.
He could tune them out.
This was absolutely a normal environment, and he would hear just as much of it as he wished to hear, and none of the rest. I know that I worked for a while on a dredge, which was an ungodly noisy thing, just tongue crashing machinery all the time, bang, 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 rushing water and machinery going, and after a while you would get to where you would hear only the aberrations. Mm-hmm. And the same with the child in the bed. There is a normal pattern of noise in the house which accounts for everything going as it should. And when something comes up different or drops out, that is what catches attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We haven't talked at all about things like impulsive noise, discrete pure tones, things of this sort. And of course, those don't appear in the simple use of a weighted level. Impulsive noises, even if they're not terribly loud, if they're a certain amount above the ambient, are annoying. Pure tones are annoying if you live next to a factory, even though the total emission isn't too great. If there's a steady hum or a steady whistle at one particular frequency, why, it becomes very, very annoying. Of course, all these factors have to be put in to study the criteria. But the simplest single thing is just to measure the total noise.
That's kind of interesting. Last election, there was a candidate who used this in his TV commercial to come out with a shrill, just about obnoxious hum to describe his opponent.
Really?
Yes.
Oh boy.
Which one did you remember as obnoxious?
Well, I was in a different state, so it didn't bother me.
The question I always like to ask, when we're talking about environment, last week we were talking about energy and its effects on the environment and so on, and the question I like to ask is, how much are you willing to pay, in this case, for quiet? Obviously, if these regulations affect commerce, well, let's take such a simple thing as the transportation criteria, the truck criteria. Okay, EPA says, and I think the regulations begin to go into effect for new trucks this fall if the regulations aren't modified. Okay, they say you can't use a certain type of tire that emits this terrific whine, that we are used to on the freeway. So they can't sell any more of those. So in a year, or a year and a half, or 2 years, those begin to disappear. All right. Then they go after the engine noise. And I guess the one of the worst offenders, next to mufflers, which that's not terribly hard. A couple $100 will retrofit any truck with an effective muffler. But one of the toughest things next to that is fan noise. And so most truck companies now offer as an option, at least on their big trucks, a thermostatically operated fan. So the fan only runs when it's actually needed to draw air through the radiator and doesn't the rest of the time. Well, I've heard estimates from $300 to $1,000 per truck. Okay, all these things, add to the cost of truck. Well, I mean, who's going to end up paying? We're going to end up paying. If trucks cost more money, it's going to cost more money to bring the goodies to the store, and, this gets passed along. Ultimately, we're going to have to pay for improving the quality of our environment. Now, the question is, how much? The If the manufacturer comes out and says, I'm going to have to raise the price so much. Or let me take another example, a garbage can. to me, that's very annoying. Our garbage gets collected about 6 in the morning, and you hear this banging of cans. Of course, they wouldn't have to bang them the way they do, but if I went and bought a can, garbage can that didn't bang and didn't ring like a cymbal, I know the noise would be less. And you can buy garbage cans like that, but they cost more. How much more are you going to pay for a garbage can that doesn't, ring like a cymbal and emit noise all over the neighborhood? After all, it's only every other day or every third day in most communities. And you wake up, you hear this, you go back to sleep. It isn't so bad. How much more are you going to pay for quiet garbage cans?
What we should do is, if you're not too embarrassed, is put your fingers like this.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
You'd have to attend this morning's eye opening.
Oh, I missed it, yeah.
Can we be affected psychologically by subliminal sound? Here, or isn't there such a thing?
Well, I don't know of a subliminal counterpart. You mean something that's of too short duration to register.
Well,
it's loud enough, but too short.
So high that we can't.
Oh, ultrasonic.
Ultrasonic?
Yeah. Probably not, although there's certainly, again, there with ultrasonic or infrasonic, which is the other end of the spectrum, things that have a frequency too low to be heard, certainly if the level is high enough, there can be physiological damage. But I don't know of any psychological damage. If our ears don't hear them, how do we receive them? There have been reports of things like nausea and things like that induced by high levels of infrasonics, but these are things that they're not liable to be subjected to. They're not liable to affect the public health and welfare, certainly. But, you have to be working in an unusual environment.
Did you consider in these OSHA rules for factories that maybe they can put earmuffs on the people?
Yeah, oh sure, there is, what they say is that if the level in a environment, in a factory, anywhere where people are employed is above 90 dBA, then the employer is responsible for a hearing conservation program. That means regular testing of an employee's hearing, providing safety devices and making sure that the workers wear them and things of this sort. But I don't know. There are a lot of manufacturers that have just kind of shrugged and said, well, okay, if it's too loud, they can wear earmuffs. But that's not such an easy solution as it seems right on the surface. Most of us wouldn't care to wear earmuffs 8 hours a day, day in and day out. And it's up to the employer to see that they do wear them. It isn't enough, according to the way I understand the OSHA laws, just to say they are available.
I worked in a manufacturer one time, and Mozart was really obnoxious, these things that let out steam, after they've been cooked. And we were supplied with earplugs, and told it would be good to wear them. But after the first week, you can't hardly tell any difference between the earplugs and not earplugs. It makes a little difference, and it's so annoying. And if your informant comes over to tell you something, you absolutely cannot hear what he's saying.
Or the fire alarm or something.
Yeah, yeah. The most noise, of course, in factories is, depending upon the level. But in most factories, at least where I've gone in, and the noise level can be lowered a great deal just by common sense. It's just like it's just like a messy room or an untidy yard or a garbage dump or anything else. You can always go in and do some things that will clean things up a great deal without much effort. then after you've done that, then it gets a little harder. But most factories before OSHA weren't even doing these just common sense tidy things. You could go in and find open air jets, and you could find machines that were just about bearings, you know, that were just about ready to pack in, and were trying to tell you something, and people weren't listening to. You know, there's just a lot of things that can be avoided. Now, in the last analysis, there are some environments that are difficult to quiet, but I don't think impossible. As someone said, anytime there's noise, that's wasted energy, and so energy is being wasted. For instance, if you're operating a big punch press, all right, if the punch comes down and whacks the hole in one fell swoop, that makes a tremendous amount of noise. It also uses only a very small percentage of the mechanical energy. Whereas if you use a lot of short blows of less energy, you'll do the job just as fast, and you'll save them in the long run. But it's just been done that way for so long. Or there are other ways to cut holes in pavements besides air hammers. There are rotating drills and things like that. But it's just been done this way for so many years, and nobody has really shown that much concern about it until recently.
What would you say about tractor noise? Like when you plow, you really have to pour on the power.
Oh, you know it.
Well, now, does that mean that there's some waste there?
Sure.
Oh.
Well, the engine isn't operating as efficiently as it could. Now, of course, any kind of an internal combustion engine is going to emit noise. And the interesting thing about tractor noise on farms is that as our style of farming changes, why farmers go from being individual enterprise to being factories of a sort. And so you can go out and operate your own tractor and ruin your own ears, but if you hire somebody to sit on the tractor, then you've got to worry about it. Because he can come back and sue you for loss of hearing. So I think all the major agricultural suppliers now will supply you with quiet tractors, with better muffling systems, cabs, enclosures, and you certainly can buy quiet tractors. But if you only operate it yourself, there's not much point in suing yourself, and so what you do is your own worry. It was about the way the law reads.
And there's no way to help the guy who rides a quiet tractor in the cab, and instead he wears earphones and listens to local radio.
Right.
Blows his head the other way.
Right.
How about the rock and roll band?
Well, I'd like to say that this was a real danger. I don't really feel that this is because of this cumulative thing. If I go to a rock concert and sit and listen to a sound at 100, 105, 110 dB for a couple of hours, I'll come home and my wife would have to shout at me. You know, the temporary threshold shift will be appreciable. But I probably wouldn't go to one at all, but I probably wouldn't go to one again for a while. And in that case, it really is not a health risk, I don't think.
For the kid that goes.
Oh, for the kid that plays, the guy that's sitting there behind the drums, yes, very definitely. And of course, there have been a lot of studies made on rock musicians, and almost every one of them shows.
self-evident that established rock musicians cannot hear.
Yeah.
What about the headphones on the kids at home, though? You can't, you know, they're not bothering you because it's all going through a headset.
Right.
But boy, I asked Kathy the other day what she was listening to up in her room, and she handed me the headset, and my gosh, my glasses fell off.
Right.
It was and I checked it. Everything was turned on full blast.
Yeah.
That's the way she wanted to hear.
Right.
I'm serious about the guy on the tractor, because that's become a way of life. The tractor radio, the radio headset, is it? You spend 8, 10, 12 hours a day on that tractor, and in season you do spend that many hours on the tractor, and when you're on the tractor, you got the headphones on, and it's go, 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 go. Mm-hmm. Lights at night.
Doesn't have to be loud, though.
Well, it doesn't have to be, but as Rich says, that's the general preference.
Tends to be, yeah.
I think most farmers know by now that music helps your plants grow.
Music for the cows?
No, that's just to make them calm.
No, there are some.
That's to distract from any other noises coming into the room instead.
No, but I'm interested in whether EPA is going to limit the sound level in these wherever they play rock and roll music. Just as well as in a factory.
Well, first of all, let me remind you now. The federal government is at least under the present legislation, is going to stay out of environmental noise. That's up to the local establishment. That's up to your municipality, probably. And when it comes to regulating noise in bars and restaurants, that would certainly be up to the municipality. Calder, for instance, amazingly enough, has been a leader in this area. They came out with a Noise Control Act some years ago, and they've written up a tremendous number of citations. Partly, this was political, but somebody got to... The nice thing about Chicago is you don't have to worry about democracy. And, you know, like we were saying the other day, democracy is inefficient. And somebody got to Mayor Daley and convinced him that it would be a good thing to have a quieter city. And in Chicago, and Mayor Daley is convinced, you know, things get done. You've got to admit that Chicago has that advantage over New York and other places.